to welcome everyone to this final Saturday session of the 2009 Socialism Conference sponsored by the International Socialist Organization. We have our last day of the conference tomorrow with a couple more sessions we hope everyone will come out to as well tomorrow. My name is Jesse Hagopian. I'm a member of the ISO up in Seattle. And I came here tonight with you all to hear about Oscar Grant and the San Francisco 8 and the history of political repression here in America. And I don't think you can really understand politics in this country without understanding the history of repression that's gone on in this country. An extraordinary level of repression, almost unmatched by brutal regimes and dictators around the world. We rival in terms of the level of repression. What do I mean by that? People should know that the incarceration rate of black people in this country is four times higher than that of South Africa under apartheid. Right? This is the type of political repression that includes, mass incarceration, that includes just violence on especially communities of color, just outright executions by the state as well. But besides that really, horrible, brutal side of history of repression in this country, there's also another history of people resisting that type of repression in our country, and courageous voices for social justice that have really defied the odds and stood up to that. And that's a history of social struggle that's actually made it a huge difference. And has changed this country and made it a better place because people have that courage. And we're very fortunate tonight, extremely fortunate, to have some of those courageous fighters who have continued that struggle against political repression to this day. And I'm very honored to introduce to you tonight some of these activists who are part of that. We're going to first hear tonight from Richard Brown, who was a former Black Panther Party member right here in the Bay Area. And he's also a member of the San Francisco 8. Eight former black community activists, mostly Black Panther Party members, who were arrested on January 23rd, 2007, all around the country from charges that stem back in 1971, if I'm right. Back in 1971, largely based on testimony from people who were tortured into confessions to try to railroad them on charges of cop killing. So I'm really excited to hear about how we can support his struggle against this political repression. Next, we're going to hear from Jack Bryson, who his two sons were on that platform that probably many of you have seen the video on YouTube when Oscar Grant was executed by police, doing absolutely nothing, lying on the ground with no sort of resistance at all, and just shot in the back. His sons were there to witness that. And Jack Bryson has been a courageous voice, I think, standing for justice in this case and getting the truth and organizing a campaign to stand for justice. Finally, we're going to hear from Dana Blanchard, who's an ISO member here in Oakland and also a member of the campaign to end the death penalty, who I think can talk about both cases and tie them together an understanding of the political repression that's happened in this country. So I'm going to give about 15 minutes for the speakers, and then I'm going to turn it over to all of us to discuss how we can help build these struggles and support these activists. So please help me welcome first Richard Brown. Thank you, bro.
brothers and sisters, I want to see that presentation so very much. I really appreciate that. I'm almost 70 years old, and sometimes it shocks me. I don't mean this in any way, people say I'm going to have 15 minutes to tell you about, you know, things that I've been doing. It's kind of, it makes it kind of rough.
No, it's all right.
But, no, I can do it. I've been practicing, so hopefully I'll be able to get some of the important things across to you within the time allotted to me, and to continue to have your support, and have you there for us, the SFA, and all people who need your support and help in the future. You know, it's important that we start organizing, start coming together, start supporting one another about any and all causes that have to do with health. When I first started out in life as a young man, I was living in the Fillmore district and grew up in an era when there was not much going for black people. Therefore, I didn't have many opportunities as a young black man in this country. I remember when I graduated from school and I honestly and truly wanted to get work and to go out and take my rightful place in society, because I had heard all my life that if you get an education, you can go out there and you can make it. But when I started trying to get a job, people were still at that time telling me we don't hire Negroes, we don't hire colored people, or laughing at me and tearing my application up and throwing it in the trash back. Whatever, it was a different world and a different day at that particular time. I made a lot of mistakes as a young man. I'm not in no way, in shape, form, or fashion, someone that's been a saint all his life. I did all the things in order to survive that young black men trapped in an environment with no opportunities. I made all the mistakes that anybody else made. I had a lot of children eventually. During that time, but before I was 20, I think around 20 years of age, I had three sons already. I was a little unemployed. So when the Black Panther Party came along, during that era, there were other things going on. There was Professor Harry Edwards. I used to listen to him before the Black Panther Party, and he started giving me some type of consciousness and some type of awareness about myself and who I was and what things were possible. When Bobby Seale and Huey Newton started the Black Panther Party, I went to Oakland. I listened to them. I studied the 10-point program. I listened to what they had to say. And I sincerely convinced me that I had the right to determine my own destiny and that I could stand up for black people in my community and for my family and for my children and try to make a different world for them to grow up in. Did not want them to grow up in the type of in the environment that I lived in, that I was in, and I wanted to do everything humanly possible, even to the point of dying, in order to bring about a change. So I joined Black Panther. It was at first, like everybody sees, the name of it was Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. We started out with a lot of guns and berets and black jackets and patrolling the police and a lot of macho stuff, which was okay. It got people's attention. And it did change things in the black community and the way the police went about dealing with black people in the community. All the murders, all the beating up, and all of the planting of evidence, that ceased overnight. The Black Panther Party started patrolling the police and the patrolling the community. But the community let us know right away that there was more important things, that we didn't have businesses, we didn't have proper schools, we didn't have proper housing, we didn't have proper medical, people were hungry, people didn't have jobs, all kinds of problems that we had. And they started asking, what you going to do about that? So we decided, well, when we're talking about bringing the people, service of the people, then we have to start listening to what the people want and trying to truly serve the people, bring about a change and make a difference in their lives. So we started having we have what we call section leaders and subsection leaders and block captains and people, so that we can actually go into the community, go into each and every house in the community, listen to people and find out what it is that they really wanted and be able to do something about that. And organize people and show them that the power lies in their hands. When we said all powers, we believed was that power lies in the hands of the people. And a united people who are together and who have the same goal and are pushing towards it, there's nothing that can stand in the way of that. There is no army, no police force, no amount of guns, no tanks, and no planes that can stop you when you are organized and you want to make a difference. And I'm talking about the masses. When the masses truly make a move, there is no force that can stop that. We believed that then, I believe it now. Which is why technically I still, even though J. Edgar Hoover and the Counterintelligence Program destroyed the Black Panther Party, they didn't destroy my concept and what I believe in and what I've been doing for all my life. It's almost 7 years, and that's certainly. There was a movement against us, the Counterintelligence Program, spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, FBI director at that particular time, in which they focused on the Black Panther Party, called us the number one threat to security in the United States, and did everything possible to undermine it, and said that they were going to destroy it legally, illegally, or any way that they could. They did every dirty trick in the book, including murder, framing people, running people out of the country, paying people to falsify, make false statements against in court and that type of thing, which is why a lot of individuals to this very day are still in jail, have been there for 35, 40, sometimes over 40 years, behind actions of the Counterintelligence Program, which when investigated by the Senate, they said that they were so illegal that they had racked up at least 300 unconstitutional and illegal acts that the Counterintelligence Program had committed, and they disbanded them. Now, all of that is fine, except they didn't hold anybody accountable, and they didn't change any of the things that had been done to people, which they couldn't give people back their lives where they murdered, like Fred Hampton and Mark Block in Chicago, which the Counterintelligence Program bragged about it. They bragged about Alternus Bunty Carter in Los Angeles and said, we didn't actually pull the trigger, but we're the ones responsible for that. Congratulations, give everybody a high five, that type of thing. So, because of that, the Black Panther Party was destroyed. And basically, at that time, we were doing a very good job of serving the needs of the people. We had breakfast programs, we had free clinics, medical clinics, we had our clothing stores, we had our own school, we were feeding people, we were doing all the rent strikes, we had people signing up to CXL, the new living and test, which is something that was running rapid in the Black community at that particular time. We had many, many programs, and some of them are still going on, and the others have been picked up by the government, and now who said from at that time that it couldn't be done. We embarrassed them and did it, so they started doing it. And now they're saying again at this time where it can't be done. So I guess we'll have to start another Black Panther Party. But because of the focus that they put on us, we incurred the hatred of police officers all over the world, mainly because we weren't afraid of them anymore. You know, Black people all of a sudden start standing up and saying, I'm a man and you don't have to respect me, but if you don't, then you got a problem. And they didn't want that. I remember when I was growing up, you couldn't even look at police officers in the eye. You couldn't do that. If he pulled you over here, keep your head down. If you looked him in the eye, he thought you were challenging him, and you're, what are you, get in the car and I'm dead, you know, and all this type of crap. So when we start standing up and saying, you know, I'm not going to do that, you don't have a right to arrest me, and as far as I'm concerned, you can get away from me and leave me alone. They definitely couldn't accept that. So they started murdering us. They started framing us. They started literally killing Panthers all over the United States. In Los Angeles alone, I think in 1970, 27 Panthers were murdered. Most of them we know by the police. Most of them were unarmed, just about 99% of them. And the others that we don't know, the community says it was the police. We don't know. They suggested after the murder. But they destroyed the party. They destroyed, ran out of the country. And they started arresting us and putting us in jail any and every time they saw us. In 1971, I think I was arrested over 70 times. One year. Never went to court, picked up, charged and released the next day or the day after. In 1971, Ingleside Station here in San Francisco was attacked after the incident in the San Quentin, in which George Jackson was murdered. And a police sergeant, I believe it was, Jack Young, was murdered at the Ingleside Station. At first, they admitted they didn't know who did it. Then they thought it was the Weather Underground. And then they just dropped it and didn't talk about it anymore. In 1973, 13 Panthers were arrested in New Orleans. And police officers from all over the United States, from Texas, from New York, California, from Louisiana, from several different, any state that had unsolved crimes, they came and conversed there in New Orleans, and they had the New Orleans Police Department hideously torture three Panthers, three of the men who were in the Panther Party, Harold Taylor, John Bona, and Reuben Scott, tortured them for days. There's a DVD I call The Legacy of Torture, History of the Black Panther Liberation Movement, which the details, and it's very graphic, so you might not want to watch it in front of children. I can't even hardly watch it anymore because I know it's about my friends and what they did to them, and it makes me sick. But they tortured them brutally for days, made them confess everything that was placed in front of them, and then took them to court before a judge. They immediately told the judge that they were tortured, and the judge threw the confessions out. Once he investigated and found out that they were held 5 days and tortured, and there were even a couple of police officers who testified to the fact that they were, and that they had been held for 5 days without their attorneys even being present while they were tortured. The confessions were thrown out. Ed Erdelach and Frank McCoy were two detectives from San Francisco who were there and more or less orchestrated everything. When they got back to San Francisco, they were ridiculed because they didn't come back with a conviction, and they called back and said, we got a conviction for Jack Young, and we got confessions. And when they got there, and San Francisco found out that they didn't have it, and that they tortured people, it kind of embarrassed them and put them, they were hoping that they would be considered evil and have their, when they, chief of police and that type of stuff, and they were actually almost canceled. So years went by, they tried to use it in the late 70s and early 80s, and each time they took it to court, judges threw it out. Then you have what is known as, 9/11, in which after that, they came up with the Patriot Act, which made certain things that were illegal before legal now, or at least in the gray area to where it's possibly legal. And then they came up with the Homeland Security, which ironically enough, they went and got most of the retired counterintelligence people, brought them out of retirement, and put them into the Homeland Security, including Ed Erdelach and Frank McCoy, two retired homicide detectives from San Francisco. They deputized them, brought them out of retirement, deputized them into Homeland Security, gave them money and told them to open up cold cases, and they came right back at us with a 37-year-old case, reopened it, and because Bush and the boys had stacked the Supreme Court, and they were hoping that if it ever got there, it would be a decision in their favor. They were running around the country at that particular time. It's still changing to this very day. Like an idiot is running around saying, torture is a good thing. You should be able to torture people. Why don't you run around with it? You don't want to go to torture and never hurt anybody. But this is the type, and they were hoping that this case would open the door for them and they could use it. The public didn't go for it. The Senate didn't go for it. And actually, it didn't work out like they thought it would. When they went to Jerry Brown and told him, first they said, we got these confessions. And in order to sweeten it, they told him they had new evidence. They had a murder weapon, they had DNA evidence, they had fingerprints, and they had 300 witnesses that would prove their case. So Jerry Brown went for it and signed on the dotted line and asked him, were you going to support me when I run to jail? And they said, yeah. And they came back to us. Once we got to court, they placed us on the $5 million bail. The judge looked at all the evidence that they so-called had, and after 7 or 8 months of trying to get the prosecution to sort of give their evidence, he finally realized that they didn't have it. The murder weapon, they admitted after a while that they lost it. They said they had it, but they lost it. And they wanted the judge to accept the fact that someone would come and testify that he did at one time see the weapon. They have DNA, strangely enough. It just doesn't match any of us. They said anything about it. And the fingerprints, at that time, honestly, when they arrested us, they were still saying that the fingerprints didn't match any of us. Because they were getting desperate and had come up with something, about 3 months ago, they had the original guy who did the fingerprint thing 30-some years ago. They brought him back, talked to him, and changed his. He now says that it does match something. After 37 years, he says it matches Francis Torres. That's going to be interesting when you get to court and they ask him, well, why they take him 37 years to resign. Well, he said, I was looking at a fingerprint from the right hand, and Mr. Torres is left-handed, so therefore I missed it, which makes no sense whatsoever. I covered them, they checked fingerprints, they checked all of them. But evidently they didn't. So that says a lot about people that he put his penitentiary all over. But the judge lowered the bill. Six of us, we were eligible, got out. We've been fighting and doing everything we can to educate the public and make sure that people understand that this is a travesty of justice. We've been trying to desperately to get to court and have a preliminary hearing. After 2.5 years, we have not even had a preliminary hearing yet. And the prosecution put it off every time it gets close to it. The three times it was put off, the trick they used was they would wait till a day or two before we were supposed to go to preliminary hearing and then bring in discovery evidence and give us anywhere from 70,000 pages to 150,000 pages of new evidence that we would have to go through, and naturally we couldn't do it within 48 or 72 hours. So they said, oh, well, we'll put it off for another 6 months, you know. And that's what's been going on. We have a date for this coming Monday, July the 6th. Now, it's an interesting, one of the things that they've been doing is asking us to plead guilty to lesser charges. And when we said that we wouldn't do it, the thing now is, the last deal was, well, if you won't plead guilty to what we are asking you to plead, tell us what you will plead guilty to. I'm not going to plead guilty to anything. I'm ready to go to court. I want my day in court. I want people to see that you get out. They have a Christian that's been in there, Herman Bell. Herman has been locked up for over 37 years. He's incarcerated in New York, primarily because of some of the evidence, the confessions that they got from New Orleans. That's really a tragic case. And the counterintelligence program back in the early 70s, what they did to him. He had three different trials. The first trial was a mistrial. The second trial was a hung jury. Those two trials did not bring in these so-called confessions from New Orleans. The third one, the judge allowed the confession to be brought in through a person, Reuben Scott, who they some kind of way got to go and say, put it on the stand so they were able to bring the confession in. And Herman was found guilty behind those confessions that Reuben Scott did and admitted under torture. And after he was found guilty, Ruben came back and said that I lied, you know, and he shouldn't be in there. He recanted his statement on national TV in front of everybody, but Herman is still there. Because he's been locked up at 850 for over 2 years, in a cell, with no windows, no fresh air, artificial light, and because of the fact that he is ill, he needs medical treatment and he can't get it there, they will not allow him out because of his status of a so-called dangerous person. He can't go out to the hospital for that type of thing. because he's been trying, he's eligible for parole, and he's trying to get back to New York for the last over two years to go before the board, and the state of California won't allow him. They're putting the type of pressure on him, keeping him there, keeping him away from medical treatment, keeping him away from his family, keeping him locked up in his tiny cell. And then they offered him a deal. Plead guilty to manslaughter, and we'll give you a year in county jail, time served, and 3 years, 5 years probation. And put all this behind you. We'll sign it on the paper that the state upstairs won't come after you anymore, and we'll send you back to New York where you can get your medical treatment and you can go to the board. And he went for it. He signed. He spoke with us. He talked to us. He allowed all of us to be in there with him. And he said he wanted to do it. He was tired. We thank you. Now, the opposite of that is, you're going to be locked up here 2 or 3 more years while you're fighting this if you don't, in this one sentence. So he said he wanted to do that, and it can't be used against any of us. So we didn't stand in his way. I told him, that's what you want to do. So they gave him probation for a so-called cop killer. And they said that he is the shooter. Here's the person that they claim pulled the trigger to kill the police officer, and they offered him a deal that gave him a year in the county jail, time served, and probation. Then they come around and ask us, what do you want? What can we give you? And I'm saying, give me a chance to get to court Monday morning so I can meet you. And I'm asking all of you to show up Monday. We'll have a demonstration at 8 o'clock. And hopefully this time the preliminary hearing will be started at 9. And honestly and truly, I'm here before you and the rest of us because of the support that we've gotten from you and everybody else and throughout the country, actually. So please continue
this
to
Monday.
Support us this Monday, day after tomorrow, at 8 a.m., 850 Bryant Street. Please come and support us and all power to you.
This around for people to sign so that you know we can keep in touch with you around the 8th.
Great, yeah. If you want more information, please sign up on this list that's going around. The card that we put on everybody's seat is information about the San Francisco 8, and I urge everybody to come out on Monday and help support them at the trial. Definitely. Thank
you. Before you leave, please come please get one of these. It gives you a lot of information about us and our families and other things that we've been doing over the years.
Great. And that passed one of the papers. Check that out as well. And I also just want to say that if Richard has to leave early, they're picking up someone from the airport that's going to come in and help them on the trial on Monday. So that's what that's about.
Okay.
So please now help me welcome Jack Brown to talk about the Oscar Grant. Thank you very much. Talking about
to be the prisoners. And if it's good to this young man.
Tom O'Pay.
Yeah,
Tom O'Pay. That's what they did to these young men in New Orleans. And I look at that video, and this is what he's saying, and I look at what Dick Cheney was saying, it's okay when the Bush administration is not okay, what they were doing over there and what they do over here. And just imagine the things that we don't know about. You know, and the thing about Guantanamo Bay, excuse my language, but those fuckers, when they come home, those are our correctional officers. And those are our police officers.
So
these are the people we're giving the green light to do what you want to the people in Guantanamo Bay. So when you come home, keep the work up. Yeah. Keep it in the black and brown community. Mm-hmm. Do it to the people who are fighting for Prop 8, to the lesbian and gay community. Do whatever you got. You got our back. You know, and just admire him, you know, and I just never thought it years later that I'll be speaking after Richard Brown. So he's a great man. Man, like, I just grown up. Man, we got Richard Brown, we got Huey Newton, Geronimo Pratt, Lane Brown, Angela Davis, George Jackson. Just all those people I used to hear about when I was growing up. You know, I always wanted to be involved with all that. I just didn't trust the double agents. Mm-hmm. That's why I never wanted to get involved. But when this happened to Oscar Grant, ain't no stopping me. I got to get involved.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, and like Che Guevara said, you know, a long time ago in the book, you know, I just was admiring. It's better to die like a man fighting for a cause than to die like a coward without a cause. You know, so, I mean, and I feel bad because, like, we got Kevin, you know, like, just people, Kevin Cooper, Maya, Troy Davis, I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Like, when does it stop? You know, like, all of us are in there. Like, we're all in there for, like, to fight the system. Something must not be us. Something got to be wrong with the system because all of us wouldn't be in here fighting for Lincoln. We're fighting for San Francisco 8. We're fighting for Oscar Grant. We're fighting for Prop 8. We're fighting for human rights. We're trying to chip this big rock out the system. You know, Sean Bell in New York, you know, and just reading Lamia's book, man, just some of the things that he says, you know, these laws and this system is created by congressmen and lawmakers who don't even understand this, who just want to build laws to keep us, to keep that foot on our neck so we don't stand up for ourselves, you know. So, you know, man, it's a trip, you know. I mean, we look at, how many of you remember the Rampart in Los Angeles?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what, 2-3 years after everything they did?
Yeah.
How many remember the Cowboys in Michigan, California? And how many remember the Miami police officers in Miami who killed a whole bunch of drug dealers, threw them overboard, and they all drowned?
Wow.
Philadelphia. Philadelphia, what they did to the mind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? These bastards were caught by the FBI. By the FBI, caught the same people that did him like that. Nothing happened to them.
Right.
Then we got the Bart police who killed Oscar Grant. See, so when you look at that video of Oscar Grant, you think of Emmett Till, Fred Hampton, Sean Bell, Bobby Hutton, even the San Francisco 8, the Jan 6, Mumaya, just everything that history was saying happened on that platform.
Uh-huh.
Like you said, he can't even look at the video. My sons and their friends can't even look at the video when Oscar Grant was executed in war. So if you look at it, there's a connection. I mean, it's just going down, going down, going down. So, you know, man, we just, like Mr. Brown said, we just got to stick together,
yes.
You know, for all causes, you know. All causes. You know, and we got to stick together. And, it's just hurtful, you know. It's like, you know, they accuse us in the communities, the black and brown communities, or they accuse everyone that we're the radicals. We're the ones that need to be in prison. And I'm not saying all bad, all police officers are bad. But what about the bad ones that are just run wild and kill and punch and do what they want? What's going to happen to them? You know, why do they get away with so many stuff? That's why this Oscar Grant case was just like he was talking about. They're coming at him with, if you take this deal, if you were in the courtroom for Oscar Grant, then it was a kangaroo courtroom. It was just like, it's, see, back in the day, before videos came out, and even one video for Oscar, all police used to say is, I thought the person was reaching for a gun, and they could sit up there and just lie. If you ever watched the old movies, like Mississippi Burning, when the family was sitting up there and the white officer got up there all nonchalant, they said, well, you know, and the judge said, it's out, you just throw it out. You know? So this is what they were trying to do in the park, in the courtroom for Oscar Grant. But we're in a new age. We're in a new age, in a new age. You know, we got a video. And this video represents everything that these police officers have been doing for our young men and women, to all of us over the years.
That's right.
That's why they're stuck right now. You know, and so that's why, I keep repeating it, that's why we have to build a solid movement in everything we do to let them know, you know, that the power is in the people. You know, and like if we can get officers that honestly murdered or put in jail for murder, for Oscar Grant, and we can free the San Francisco 8, we can get Kevin Cooper free, we can get Troy Davis free, and we can get Maya free. That's a stepping stone in the direction that we can be going. I just want to, like, since this happened to Oscar, you know, like I said, life hasn't been the same. Like my oldest son, Jackie, he was like this with Oscar when Oscar was executed. My other son was right there, and the other two young people were there. And man, it's hard to look at him. It's hard to talk about it. And then they were also took him to jail after Oscar was murdered. You see the pattern of the same thing to everyone else. So who's lying? So I just want to share something with you. Give me 1 minute. Excuse me. I've been reading this book. It's called Stolen Lives. I recommend everybody read it. Everyone should read this because it just shows, you know, like I said, they keep thinking they thought. So all these young men would have a video, these police officers would be in jail, and the police departments would be beaten. You know, that this is. Frankie Alvarado, New York. Frankie was a 15-year-old Puerto Rican youth, a passenger in a car that was pulled over by police on January 12, 1996, in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn. The police claimed that they fired on the car when the driver tried to drive off. Frankie's parents, David and Lily Forrest, later obtained a medical report indicating that Frankie had been shot at close range. No action has ever been taken against the officers involved in the shooting. On Mother's Day, following Frankie's death, police telephoned and tormented his mother, Lillian. The family has a room in their apartment displaying Frankie's favorite things like red toy cars and photographs of Frankie, his gravesite, and many protests and police brutality hearings the family has been a part of. So, when Abra Lumina was beaten and tortured by police on the 17th
in 1770 precinct, one measure of the New York City Department took to replace the 17th captains. Frankie's parents pointed out to anyone who would listen that the replacement was none other than a captain from the Bushwick police mm-hmm. where the son had been killed. Do you remember that young man who the police they tortured and they stuffed up? So I'm just saying, and it was the same captain that's in charges. He was the officer that killed Frank. We have a captain in internal affairs. About 10 years ago, he beat Jerry Lamar, and his promotion was to internal affairs as a captain of the police department. We have two police officers that were involved in the cover-up, Oscar Grant, that was recently just promoted.
Right. Mm-hmm. They were promoted?
They were promoted to the training on police brutality and how to control riot crimes.
That's insane. That's sick.
My time is up, but I'm sorry, but I thank everyone, and keep saying this, my favorite song, like Bob Marley said, stand up. Thank you so much.
All right, well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm so honored to be speaking with you two gentlemen, and you inspire me every day, and it's such a blessing to have you here telling your stories, and I'm going to do my best to follow you. And I'm actually going to start with a quote from another one of my favorite people, Frederick Douglass, because it is the 4th of July, and there's a very famous, I haven't yet heard it today, so I'm going to share a short snippet of it with you. And I'm going to end my talk with another statement from someone else who I consider one of my heroes, Daryl Lomax, who's locked up at San Quentin, who's someone that I work with, who's also a fighter in struggle, who can't be here in person, but I want to share his words. So I'm going to bookend my talk with the words of some other people that I admire. So, Frederick Douglass, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. And I would say that rings true today, just as much as it did back when he spoke in front of Congress. And I would say the cold-blooded murder of Oscar Grant, the torture of innocent men like the SF-8, the injustices that go on every day, this is, at this very hour, the bloody savagery of the United States government. And we should not forget that, and we should remember these words on this, our National Independence Day. So I want to talk a little bit about the prison system, and I want to talk about the repression that's happening I'm going to focus most in the last 25 years on the basic prison expansion project that the United States has undergone. We live in an incarceration nation. There's no exaggeration to say that it is America's gulag, I would say. There are 2.3 million people behind bars right now and another 5 million who are on parole or probation, which means they can't vote, they're treated like criminals, and in an economy like today's economic crisis, they probably can't find work because of felony convictions. The U.S. incarcerates more people than any other country in human history. But the U.S. does not oppress everyone equally with the prison system. The country's jails are filled with people of color, primarily black and Latino youth, and though many of us would love to see people like Bernie Madoff go to jail for the rest of his life. You have to look very hard in prison to find a rich person, and certainly to find a politician behind bars has been more of a rare occasion. We are in a priority crisis right now, and especially in the state of California. I want to talk about those priorities right now. The prison project in California is the state's priority.
Right.
If they prioritized us and services and the things that we would like to see, right now if they released 20,000 people from California's prisons, which is about a fifth of the people who are in prison right now in California, $800 million would be freed up. There is the end of our budget crisis, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Are they going to do that? No? But that's a priority crisis, and I think it's up to us to talk about that. So those of you who were in Cameron's talk and Crystal's talk yesterday may have heard some of these statistics. I'm just going to run through a couple statistics. I think it's important that people understand the racism and the repression that happens under our prison system. Blacks represent 13% of the U.S. population, but are 50% of the prison population. Black men represent 6% of the U.S. population, but are 40% of death row prisoners. Black and brown youth are more than 10 times more likely to be sent to juvenile detention than white youth. And this is a crazy statistic, close to 50 times more likely to be sentenced to prison time for drug offenses. So I'm going to talk a little bit about something called the war on drugs. It's really the war on poor Black and Latino youth. And that's what we should call it, because that's what it looks like. 50 times more likely for you to be sent to prison for a drug conviction, even if it's your first charge. When we look closely at how racial disparity like this is even possible, we have to look at the last two statistics. These represent the institutionalized war on people of color in this country that has been going on full force, I would say, really, for the last 25 years, although certainly throughout history, as we look back to Frederick Douglass, there was certainly a number of things going on in his time, like slavery, that were completely abhorrent. But in the last 25 years, what I'm going to focus on, because I think it's the thing we talk the least about, the politicians call it tough on crime and the war on drugs, and more recently, since 9/11, the war on terror. We must call it what it really is, institutionalized racism. There's a direct line from the unjust laws of today and the repression of eras past. Slavery, black codes, Jim Crow, and lynching. There's a direct line. In order to understand what's happening today, we need to go back and look at what happened in this country during the Civil Rights Movement, and in particular the fight back that took place in the Black Power movements of the late 60s and 70s, led by soldiers in struggle like Richard Brown and the Black Panther Party. In America's urban centers, the battles raged between groups like the Black Panther Party and the police. People took back their neighborhoods. People provided social services that were not being provided by the states. And frankly, that scared the politicians. City Hall had to find a way to crack down. And crack down they did. And so coming out of the 60s and 70s, there was an economic crisis, and it became the excuse to basically institute repressive programs like COINTELPRO, let the FBI loose on neighborhoods, and basically destroy these urban centers that people had fought to take back. And I want to quote somebody here. We know who's on our side. I think most of us in this room, we know who's on our side. I want to talk a little bit about their side, because I don't think we always necessarily know who our enemy is. I mean, maybe most of us do. I want to put Ronald Reagan up there, and I want to read a quote from him, because this is from his mouth. This is their project. Every day the jungle draws a little closer. Our streets are jungle paths after dark. He said this in 1983, I believe. It is man's determination to live under the law that has pushed back the jungle down through the centuries. With all our science and sophistication, the jungle is still waiting to take over. The man with the badge is the only one who holds it back. That is their project.
That's the cowboy run.
Such naked racism is a bit shocking. What are they so afraid of? Yeah. So shocking to some in this room, but, you know. The militant struggles against racism and for human rights in general scared the powers that be. This is what they were afraid of. To see people taking back their communities, organizing in urban centers like Oakland, rising up against gentrification and substandard city services, and pitching battles with the cops, who had frankly run rampant in communities and were now all of a sudden on the defensive. This is what they were afraid of. With the economic crisis of the mid-1970s, this wasn't an opportunity for their side to push back. And I would say that's really the start of what we see the tough on crime agenda becoming more prolific. Since then, we've seen a rollback of many of the gains of the struggles in the 1960s and an outright attack on the working class in this country. Real wages have plummeted, and policies of big business and corporate greed have left everyone behind, but in particular, people of color in this country. In particular, the drive to incarcerate has become the ruling class's solution to the question of racism, and it has become their divide and conquer strategy. So throughout history, they've used different strategies to keep us divided. All right, I mean, Frederick Douglass, go back to him, you know, divide each to conquer all. This is their strategy. This has been their policy, really, for the last 25 years. Tough on crime, incarceration, prisons, not schools, prisons, not any other social service. This has been their project. The gains of the civil rights movement got rid of Jim Crow segregation, but people like Reagan brought us tough on crime instead. And the massive prison building project of the last two decades has come hand in hand with militarized cops on the street, militarized BART cops in the last few years since the war on terror began. Mandatory sentencing laws like the Rockefeller drug laws, which if people know are actually up for debate right now, and are, I mean, there may be a significant rollback on some of those, but outrageous mandatory sentencing laws for drug offenses, an expansion of the death penalty, and hand-in-hand with this, an underfunding of every single social program that matters to people. Anybody needs to look at the state of California right now. They are issuing IOUs to people. There is basically no health care for people. And I know I'm a teacher. We may be furloughed this year, 5 days. I mean, 5 days without pay for teachers, all at the expense of this prison and tough on crime project. The tough on crime agenda did not happen, though, in a vacuum. It was the result of the economic and social crisis, coupled with a ruthless ruling class that gave some people a place at the table and kicked everyone else out into the cold, along with all the blame for what was happening in society. So not only did they say, we're going to crush the civil rights movement, we're going to blame the leaders of the civil rights movement for your problems, and we're going to lock them up and throw away the key. Throughout the 1980s, Reagan oversaw a massive transfer of wealth from the workers to the rich, and destroyed lives along the way by gutting social spending on everything, from school lunch programs, famously that ketchup is a vegetable, I mean, honestly, to health care, to welfare, full frontal assault on ordinary workers in this country. And I want to quote from Paul Wright, who's a former prisoner and author and editor of Prison Legal News, and he explains it really well, the kind of project that the ruling class undertook in the 80s. It says, there has been a political decision made by the legislators and the executive branch. They want a permanent underclass. Setting prisons in rural areas far from the urban centers that generate the most prisoners, cutting off contacts with community and family support networks, denying contacts with families through exorbitant prices for phone calls, draconian visiting policies. Anybody who visits the San Quentin knows that this all rings true. These are the things you would do if your goal was to create an alienated, isolated, non-functioning underclass of people who cannot ever be reintegrated into society. That is their project. That is why recidivism in California is 70%. They're not rehabilitating people. They are creating a permanent underclass of people. And that underclass, the folks who are sitting in our cells and not in our universities, are mostly faces of color. Make no mistake, these policies continue far beyond the Reagan years. The Clinton era, the first Democrat in the White House in 15 years, did not bring change, only extended the tough on crime agenda. He notoriously actually flew home during his campaign to oversee the execution of a mentally retarded man, Ricky Ray Rector, who actually was so muddled that he tried to save his dessert from his last meal for after his execution. This is not the face of a new set of policies, it's a continuation of the Reagan years. Under Clinton, the prison population doubled. His 1994 omnibus crime bill provided $8 billion for new prison construction, and in 1996, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act ended welfare, limited appeals, and added 58 crimes to those punishable by the federal death penalty. And many of us who work with prisoners today are still dealing with this, in that the Effective Death Penalty Act actually has limited the number of appeals. So people are actually, we're coming into an era in California right now where there are a number of people coming up on their last appeal. Hundreds of people on death row in California who have run out of their appeal process because of Bill Clinton's laws. So make no mistake, he was not a break, but yet a continuation. This is the legacy of neoliberalism at home and abroad, and we are living today with today. But I want to say that this era, I think things have changed. I mean, the theme of this discussion is the new left for a new era. I want to talk a little bit now about what I think that new era means, because I want us to throw that old era into the trash bin of history. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some fight. But I do think there's some opportunities there, and I want to end with that. So let's look at American repression today. With the election of the first black president in 2008, many Americans have seen something come to pass that many of us thought we would never see. In a country founded on slavery and the repression of African Americans, we have a black president, and I think that means something very important. But another thing has happened alongside with this historic presidency that has significance in the work that we do today: the collapse of the world economy. With the economic crisis, we've seen an attack on all working Americans, but black America has been even more adversely affected. While unemployment among all workers stands at 10% in California, among blacks it is closer to 15%, and among young people of color, the statistics are even worse. In some communities in the state and around the country, 45% of black youth are unemployed, and our president has had very little to say about this situation. And that doesn't count all the people who are underemployed or who have given up on trying to find jobs, so I'm sure the statistics are even worse. In terms of the housing crisis, no one has been brought up on charges by the government for forcing subprime loans on black families who are often not given another option other than a subprime loan, even if they qualify for a better loan. Racism has only become exacerbated by the economic crisis. But the economic crisis has had other effects too. The government prison project, fueled by tough-on-crime policies, is coming up against a real shortfall in funding. And it looks like in some cases the state will actually have to back off some of its plans. Not because they don't want to see everybody locked up, but because they literally cannot afford to carry out the policies that were instituted under the last 25 years. Can I start to wrap up? Sorry. That was one more little... Now I lost my place. Sorry. Okay. So their project is still to create this permanent underclass that Paul Wright talked about, but their ability to actually institute that plan, I think, is coming up against some real concrete constraints. This has opened up a real opportunity for those of us who are fighting the criminal justice system. Things like an end to the harsh Rockefeller drug sentencing laws that I mentioned earlier, getting rid of three strikes in California, even ending the death penalty, are all within the realm of possibilities in this new era. But it's going to take a real fight. It's not an inevitable ending. Remember, I started with the priorities. Their priorities have not changed. This fight cannot just be a morally opposed to tough on crime policy fight. We must actually take on institutionalized racism and the racism that is behind this project. If we fail to see the connection between the struggle against racism and the struggle against the incarceration project our ruling class has shoved down our throats for the last 25 years, we will not win the kind of change we really want to see. We have to fight for the SF8 and justice for Oscar Grant, and know that these individual cases are linked up with a larger fight, an anti-racist fight, to throw the tough on crime agenda away once and for all. And I want to end with, I said I was going to end with one of my other favorite people, and this is direct from Daryl Lomax on death row, and he ends with three very powerful words that I hope will inspire us. My brothers and sisters of the human race, it is on us to do what we can and do as required to make sure the police do not come into our neighborhoods and abuse and murder any of us ever again like they did Oscar Grant. As we have seen with the fight for justice for Oscar Grant, it takes us raising hell collectively to get the wheels of justice to even begin to move in our direction. I am proud of all of you who have stood up and made your voices heard. And while we still have much to do, we have shown the world that people do have power. I am Oscar Grant. The process of murdering me began and has been going on ever since my arrest and conviction for a crime I did not commit. We must stand up and fight against the slaughter of innocent people, whether it is by cop bullets in the streets or by the lethal injection needle on death row. Resist, resist, resist.
so much. That left us with so much to talk about, and we have time to have a full discussion about all this. I'm from Seattle, and I know where I'm from, you know, they just closed 5 schools in our city, 13 other programs, and they're building a $200 million jail at the same time, right? So I know that's not an isolated case, that you guys all probably have, you know, different examples of the kind of political repression that we've talked about, but I think are important to share that story, and I think also important to talk about how do we start to build a resistance to that, what's different about this political period that will allow us to begin to build some resistance to that. And so I want to hear from you guys, and if you have questions for the panelists, you can have them come back in at various points to answer as well. And so I'm going to just ask you to wrap up at about 2 minutes, and so we can give everybody time to speak here tonight. So I'm going to take a list, and we'll get started. We'll start right here, and go around. Just keep your hands up until I acknowledge you, so I can make sure to get you. Okay, go ahead.
Those statistics are so persuasive. All this wondering, disseminating these statistics, what the sources for them are, also if there are multiple institutions doing studies, do the numbers differ? Perhaps showing ideological skewings. Yeah, maybe some more. Oh, we've got a camera in this here as well. The presentation was really great yesterday. Yeah, just wondering what sources and if there are multiple institutions on these statistics, the moons and Dale, et cetera.
That's right here on the red shirt.
Okay. Yeah, there's so much to talk about with all these cases, but I have to talk about a close friend of mine, because I think the case of the San Francisco 8 shows that COINTELPRO is alive and well right now, COINTELPRO. But there's another way in which COINTELPRO is alive today, which is the Green Scare. And if people haven't heard about it, it's where the federal government is going after environmental activists. Yep. And it sounds shockingly familiar. So this friend of mine, she was an environmental activist in college. She'd done some tree sits. She spent a summer making this documentary about all this community organizing she'd done to talk about how the environmental movement needs to forge links with the communities, work with the lumber people, that they're not the enemy, that it's the corporations that are the problem. Makes this whole documentary. Okay, fast forward a few years. There's a fire at a university research lab. Nobody's hurt. But the FBI, then 9/11 happens, then the FBI has all these new powers to go after people as domestic terrorists. So they find somebody who they think had been involved in this arson. They said, we're going to charge you as a terrorist. We're going to put you in jail for 50 years unless you name names and cooperate, which is a very similar dynamic. So they start cooperating and they name names. FBI goes to those people and say, well, we have all these powers now to put you in jail forever as a terrorist unless you cooperate and name names. One of those people, allegedly, after like the fifth time the FBI interviewed them, who was herself facing 50 years, said, oh, yeah, Breonna Waters, she was the lookout. That's right, yeah. And so they go to her and they say, well, we know you're a terrorist and we're going to put you in jail forever unless you cooperate and name names. What the hell are you talking about? I'm a music teacher and I have a 3-year-old daughter and you can talk to my lawyer, I guess. So she refused to cooperate. She went to trial. The FBI had fabricated this whole case against her. There's no physical evidence. I don't even have time in 2 minutes to go into all the outrageous things about her trial. They handpicked the judge, who was incredibly, just basically like the judge was another wing of the prosecution. Everything the prosecution wanted happened, anything the defense put forward to try and poke holes in this fabricated case to show that the FBI was lying and had fabricated everything, it was all thrown out, not admissible, blah, blah, blah. So she was eventually convicted of arson and sentenced to 6 years, separated from her 3-year-old daughter. And in a supreme act of inhumanity, even though the judge, in fact, suggested that she do her time here in California close to her daughter, her lawyers, her friends, her family, they said, no, that would be a security problem. We're going to have you do time in Connecticut. Much like Dan was talking about, the separation and the inhumanity of it, of like, well, we're just going to say, screw you. So I don't at all mean to like downplay the physical torture that people face in our prisons, but this is another form of torture, to separate a mom from her 3-year-old daughter. And this is a form of torture against a completely innocent 3-year-old girl who's now not going to see her mom until she's 11, if like everything goes to what's going to happen. So I'm going to be able to... Yeah, I got to wrap up. So we're going to try and put pressure on Barbara Lee to call the Bureau of Prisons and get them to transfer her back here. We're trying to mount an appeal. And, you know, I just wanted to end and say, you know, I don't have time to really go into it all, but I'm trying to write some more about this, so people should keep an eye on socialistworker.org, and hopefully we'll start to get a campaign going. Her name's Breonna Waters.
I have it right here in Matthew, and then in the striped shirt.
Hi, I'm Matthew from Portland. I had a couple things to say about the criminal or justice system, how it operates. Firstly, one of the interesting things to point out with the war on drugs is that I work at a minimum wage call center for fast food, and a lot of people that I work with are young people with drug convictions, and one of the really messed up things that happens is with the denial of federal financial aid to people that want to go to school if they have drug convictions. I mean, there are so many people that I work with who would go to college if they could, but are not able to because they can't get the money to because of their past convictions, which is messed up. Because, you know, how else, a way to actually better yourself and improve yourself for education actually being denied you and then put into this minimum wage work situation is a way of creating cheap labor that's really disgusting. Another thing, in terms of fighting the criminal justice, we had an example from Oregon that came up of how not to fight it in this last election year in 2008. We had a ballot initiative on the ballot, Measure 57, I think, which created mandatory minimum sentencing for property crimes, like really draconian, you know, 2 years for this, 5 years for that, horrible sentences. And the response to that was for the Democrats in the state legislature to refer another initiative, which is essentially almost as severe, and then attach a little bit of funding for drug programs to it. But then try to get that passed as an alternative measure, which would be, you know, still minimum sentences, maybe a few months less. And what happened was that liberals working in the Democratic Party, working for campaigns, all actually worked them as other measures to get it passed because it would supersede the other ballot measure. You know, that one would take effect instead of the more draconian one, I guess. So they worked on this. I talked to all these people that are like, we've got to pass this horrible ballot measure, otherwise the other one will pass. And, you know, people are never going to vote. People are going to vote for one of these because people are so against crime. And we've got to message it that way. And it was ridiculous. What ended up happening was that the worst one, the first one, ended up failing anyway. It got less than half the vote. And the one the Democrats passed, the one that was supposedly less draconian, that one passed. And so we ended up with mandatory sentences anyway, which are going to put more people in jail for longer periods of time. And this was actually a campaign that was supported by, you know, liberals and Democrats, which is just ridiculous. And I definitely think that we have to actually have a stronger movement against the injustice system that can actually stand up and say, you know, saying you're going to have mandatory minimum sentences that are a little bit less harsh, that's not the way we're going to fight when these right-wing ballot measures come up, you know.
Right.
So you got to make a stand against them.
Right here, and then,
thank you so much.
Last time there was a preliminary hearing, we had hundreds of people, and one of the reasons that the prosecution is beginning to, like, you know, look to get out of this is because the central reason the community supports. So whoever can help, please.
All right, I'll be working with Roger to help organize that. I'll be there at 8 o'clock.
Great.
Thank you. Okay. Right here, and then in the back.
My name's Dave. I'm from San Diego, but I was born and raised in the Detroit area. And I remember as a kid, real vividly, watching the riots happen on TV in '67, I believe it was. And you know, still to this day, There's people that I know, white people that I know that will, you know, they'll look at that and they'll say, yeah, those dumb lazy niggers, you know, ruined our city. I mean, still to this day, there was just so much misinformation and purposely denial in the media and everything of what really sparked that. And again, this was it was a case of police brutality that sparked that. And And what happened was you had to look at all the alternative media. That was the only source, where you could really find out that this was the actual cause. And again, I'm seeing this kind of thing happen. It's resurfacing with Katrina. Again, all those same issues. And I just wanted to see if anybody would want to comment to, just with this worsening economic situation that we have, if you think that there's a potential, for all that, those kinds of things to, start happening again, and what we may be able to do to build the coalition. We can definitely got to avoid those kinds of things happening again.
Thank you very much. Before you speak, just I want to remind people to say your name and where you're from. We have like 16 people on the list already, so I appreciate people keeping their comments short, and I apologize if I can't get to everybody, but we're going to try our best. So we'll have brother in the back, and then
Michael,
and then right in the back as well.
Michael from the Mission Branch in San Francisco. Hey, one of the things we can do is link movements. Someone talked about what's happening in Guantanamo. It's also happening in Abu Ghraib. You had one of the guards who was in Abu Ghraib, who was a former prison guard, I believe it's in Pennsylvania. And so you have this, people get arrested here, or they're detained in, Guantanamo or Bagram or whatever secret prison they have. They're beaten, tortured, confessions, of course. What's the difference, here or there? You have basically the same thing that's going on. The police and the military are basically the forces of American capitalism, protectors of private property. Whenever someone resists, they're going to be the target, either of the police or the military. Here, for example, if you're looking at the Black Panthers, I remember when Fred Hampton was here, or in Philadelphia where they dropped the bomb on the moon. Devastated an entire block, Or, overseas when you talk about Iraq, people resisting, American imperialism there, So, just to sort of link these movements and also look at the cost of it, the cost of the oppression. $1 trillion for the Iraq and Afghan wars, and they want to restart the death penalty in this state. And it's estimated that the cost is going to be $1 billion. That can go to the schools. So if you want to, we can pay for health care, we can pay for education, all these things that we actually need, by ending these wars and then the death penalty. That would be one of the things you could do. There was a UN report that just came out talking about racial profiling. Well, yeah, it still exists. But the thing is that the same policies that were in place in the previous administration are still in place now, which means this current administration, even though the AG talks about, this is probably the first part of getting rid of racial profiling, they've done nothing, to actually do that. Down in the South Bay, we actually had a police chief in Palo Alto who basically rationalized racial profiling, saying it's okay in this circumstances, but it's basically the policy of the police department. Anyway, we had a demonstration in November, middle of November last year, and by December, she was announcing her retirement. So, that's a small victory. No big, but a small victory.
Thank you very much. Before Joe in the back goes, also, if you have a question, if you want to let me know right now and I can prioritize you, if you have a question for our panelists or a question for the room, I can get you up ahead, and so we can get that answered as well. And then after Joe, I have right here in the middle.
The show I hate the most on TV is Law and Order, both Criminal Intent and Special Victims Unit. Because they always portray the police as the most high-minded people who won't let the pursuit of justice and truth get in their way. That's not the police I know. You know the opening line, you know, the two wings of the state. The police arrest you for crimes you didn't commit. The district attorney convicts you on the basis of false evidence. Or it should be that way, right? I mean, that's the police field. Jack mentioned one thing I think is worth about the issue of the torturers, the cops, the military police from Guantanamo, the regular military police, coming back and being the foot soldiers in American cities. We all know this is true because in Chicago, where I live, John Birch has put hundreds of young, mostly black and Latino men in prison for crimes that they didn't commit based on torture. We know that he committed these acts even though the Daley administration spent $7 million over 7 years trying to cover up police torture in Chicago. It actually, at the end of the day, it was revealed that torture did take place. And Burrage himself is actually going to be going on trial very soon in February. The only reason that this is happening is because of the People's Law Office, the investigative reporter Jack Conroy, the campaign to end the death penalty, who stayed on Burrage all these years, and that when he was cacheted out, after all this stuff came public, you know, that he used Army field phones to torture most of the folks, you know, along with much cruder methods, things that are considered primitive by the standards of Guantanamo today, they stayed on him for the last 15 years to make sure that he didn't have a comfortable return. And the lesson of that, I think, for all of us, is that you can't let it go, right? They try to wear us down. They try to demoralize us. But the fact is that there has been a sea change about how people view these issues in this country. If you go back 20 or 30 years ago and you said that the police regularly torture and beat confessions out of people, most of the population, and a sizable chunk of black and Latino people, would have probably said, ah, those are exaggerations. Oh, I'm sure it's true in some cases. But the scale of it that's been revealed is important. Things have changed for our side. Let's stay on the fight and we can win.
Okay, my name is Celeste. I'm from Martyr for Democratic Society. I just want to make a short announcement, actually. It's about the SFA. San Francisco Print Collective is doing a poster making project to make posters in support of the SFA. And it's really easy to get involved. You don't even have to know how to screen print, they'll teach you. You don't even have to be involved in the making of the posters. You can just be involved in putting them up. So I really recommend anybody who's interested in this project, contact us, sfprintcollective.com, or you can talk to me, and I'll give you the information. And Steve has something.
Okay, we're just going to do a split comment here. I just want to say really quickly that we both live in the Fruitvale District. I love that neighborhood for a lot of reasons. But I take the BART every day to work. It's fucking eerie to be on a BART platform every day and have nothing there to memorialize Oscar Grant, have nothing, you know, it's just creepy to be there. And to see them back, the first day, the cops weren't there for 2 months after this happened. And the first day that they were back there was the day that that Messerly was arraigned or whatever, the first day that they brought him back in. That was the first day that they were back. And you know, it's just crazy. And we're talking about that Frederick Douglass quote of like dividing people. How do they do that? They do that by they used to do it through regular segregation, by actually keeping people physically apart. Now they do it by different treatment of different people. The way that they come down so hard on young people, on black people, on Latinos, and that creates like a totally different situation. That, you know, then you have, you know, white people don't even believe black people when they say, oh, I, you know, like driving while black, or any of this stuff that is really common in people now. And people often say, you know, protests don't matter and things like that. And I have to say that the immigrant rights marches that went through that neighborhood, I saw, I mean, it sounds cheesy in our like cynical time or whatever, but to see like people of all like races and age groups like actually like hugging each other. And like I saw, you know, like young black people, like, you know, giving, you know, the Black Power salute, you know, as these Latino marches went through, saying, you know, this is what it's about, it's unity, and that's such a powerful thing that you know, that's what the cops are scared of, is people coming together and saying, your fight is our fight, and
just get the question real quick first right here and then go
back. My name is Michael B. and I'm going to try to respect the speakers here by not giving a speech. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I have two questions real shortly. You really drew the connection between the neoliberal policies and the enforcement on the streets, and that really rung with something I'm reading right now. I'm reading Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine. Her partner started this bank to fund workers' struggles, and I was wondering if you guys have made any connection with that bank, which is funding struggles of oppressed minorities in the third world. The other question I had was about apartheid in America, because to me, apartheid, when I think apartheid, I think a colonial state enforcing racial separation, inequality through violence. And I don't know if that's a correct definition of apartheid, but I was wondering if you guys thought it was, what your thoughts were on that.
The civil rights movement in the 60s, I think one of the things that really helped build it was the contradiction between what the U.S. said it was doing and the freedoms it said it was spreading around the world through the Cold War and imperialism and invading countries like Korea and Vietnam, and what Jim Crow looked like in the South. And I think that this panel is really fantastic, and an organization called the Campaign at the Death Penalty back there is really fantastic in that it puts the face on the criminal justice system of what it actually looks like, because it's held up as this, you know, just, lofty, you know, body that can arbitrate and can figure out right from wrong, and you know what Joe was saying about law and order, all that. But really, what we look at, you know, is what happened to Oscar Grant, and you know, and the case that was laid out as far as the SF8, like it's disgusting to me, but people are on death row for cases that look quite a bit like that, and our support of the SF8 right now is vital to make sure that doesn't happen right now, and I think that we can see the way the court system works, the racism, the injustice, the fabricated evidence, the police misconduct, and really I think that we need to see right now our job to expose that, to build civil rights movement on that basis. And the Campaign to End the Death Penalty, for folks that don't know, is a national grassroots organization that we are made up of inmates, of families of people on death row, of their friends, and activists, and we seek to make a connection to the prison system that actually puts the struggles of people who are living through it to the forefront, and doesn't let this totally crap version of the way the justice system works be the final word. And we need your support, you know. And this right here is a really easy way to do it. It's the Campaign to End the Death Penalty Sustained Reform. There can be found on that table there, along with quite a bit of really good literature. Kristen, who just waved her hand. And, you know, really, we are fighting racism. We are doing everything we can to build a civil rights movement. And this, unfortunately, is a time for nonprofits it's rough, you know. And so we would really appreciate your support for the price of a beer every month. $5 is about the least we can take out of a credit card. You do a world of difference to the folks that we work with to the struggle for civil rights. And you can get a free book from Mumia for signing up to be sustained. So, I think that it's a...
Jailhouse Lawyers is like one of the number one sellers right now.
Yeah.
For free if you sign up to sustain.
Yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, definitely want to encourage people. Also, just to be clear, if people throw out questions, other people can answer them on the floor, and our panelists can come back whenever they want, maybe at the end, just depending. So we'll get to questions. If there's any other questions, please let me know, and I can prioritize them right now, right here in the middle, and then over here.
I just wanted to say, and I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to say it before Richard Brown left, I just wanted to tell him that what he did in becoming a Panther and having that movement made a difference. It made a difference in the psyche of Black people. It made a difference in terms of the change among the generations. The next generation was much different. So that was a good thing. But the most important thing is that there was a lot of strategies learned during that time. The counterintelligence forces we learned about how they work, and that's why I want to say this to Jim Webb, because not only did they destroy the Panthers externally, they destroyed them internally too. There was a lot of fighting, a lot of ugliness that was going on internally. That's something that we need to learn in terms of how to build this movement. We need to learn not to allow the dropping of a whisper about another person and then having that person pushed out and everybody say, pointing fingers. We've got to do a little bit better about that. And the other thing is, we've got to stop preaching to the choir. If we want to build this movement, we've got to take it out. And like you were saying about the television shows, there's technology now. We can make our own shows. We need to take all of the resources that we have to make messages, whether it's print, whether it's electronic, or on the radio, blogging, internet, but we need to be on that media, and we need to do in-person stuff. We need to be out in front of schools, doing little shows, letting children know that it's not okay to put people in prison the way they do in Europe. We need to go into churches. We need to stand out on the street. We need to draw crowds. And we need to congregate in numbers, because there is safety in numbers. So I think that that's the message that I want to make, because I was there. I was alive when the Panthers were operative. I was a young woman. And I know what the benefits were, and I also know the mistakes. And I think we need to get people who have that experience and use their expertise that they've built through that process and use that, draw upon that. We need to take down that information. And to really build a movement, it's not just enough for us to do it among ourselves. We got to go out. Thank you.
Greg, right here. Big Steve, across from Seattle, and you don't come across that, claim no easy victories, right? So the gentleman back here talking about his small V victory, I'm going to share one with y'all. Back in 1998, there was a car wreck up in the central area where a lot of my people live, right? And we went to help, pass through the traffic inside of it, right? So all the black folks going in there, bring those in the back, pulls the seat back so he can breathe, right? Because, he's got a dashboard in his back. Paramedics show up, tell us to get out of the way, okay? What do you think? Police show up, take my friend, threw him on the hood of the car, and yeah, you're under arrest. And all the whole crowd's there saying he didn't do anything. He was trying to help, he didn't do anything. So then, that was the white officer. The black officer comes over to me and tells me what happened. And of course, now everybody's shouting, so I have to talk like this so everybody can hear that we were over in the park and we were exercising, talking to the bell around the corner, goes into the telephone pole, right? So we tell him all this, he lets my friend off the hood, and we see another officer on the corner, and he's taking notes, so let's go over there, give my information, be responsible. Same officer goes after my friend, this is what I tell you to do, something you got, and starts going after him. I was like, big deal, we just told you what happened. So he goes to my throat, so I lit him up. Okay. I've been doing martial arts since I was 7. I've all tried to teach in their academy of martial arts, but I don't. I teach bouncers. I've been a bouncer for almost 14 years. Jesse will tell you. I'm in pretty much almost every club in the town. So, yeah. I also work very closely with the hip-hop scene out there. A lot of the artists. I do personal protection for Cynthia McKinney. She probably wouldn't be locked up if she took me with her like I asked her to. Okay. As well as Africa. King County prosecutor won't touch a potential pull, so the city of Seattle decides to prosecute it. And they're having a bad day in court when their first witness that they called gets up and says, yes, when I came on the scene, the police tried to control. That's their witness. And it just went downhill from there after my defense attorney, was actually very good, goes after he starts grilling this officer who tried to attack me, who wrote his police report, numerous punches and kicks to the head, and came into court with his eyes swollen. Okay? And so, after all that, hollering and screaming at my attorney, hollering and screaming at the judge, and being warned with a contempt charge, found not guilty. along with my Kobe fans.
You found not guilty?
Found not guilty. So then we took their ass to civil court. Yeah, we took their ass to civil court and won that too. We would have gotten the $11 million if it hadn't been for 9/11, but instead we got the $50,000 apiece plus court costs. You can do it. Even if you have these extreme circumstances, you can do it as long as your ducks in a row, your facts are straight, and you're always respectful.
That's unusual.
You know, you can still get the exact point that is. I'm standing here live in front of you today. Because I did what was necessary from beginning to end. Knowledge, wisdom, understanding, okay, completion. And everybody else can do it too.
I have right here in the front row, and then after that, Sarah, black shirt in the center of that. And yeah, right here.
Yeah. Dave in D.C., police brutality is a constant issue in Washington, D.C. Just very quickly, I knew it was a big topic of conversation in my house when we were driving in the car with my 5-year-old daughter and my mother-in-law, and the police went by, and my little girl said, "Duck the popo." And my mother-in-law was like, "What are you teaching her?" is the answer. I got to say, Dana, Jack, Cam, what you guys are doing is making a big difference around the country. A lot of you are from West Coast. I'm on the East Coast. We talk about Oscar Grant all the time. And we talk about what you're doing all the time, and it's making a real difference. I just want to tell Hal so you guys know that this is having real influence. There's a neighborhood in D.C. called Trinidad. There were 5 murders in one night. People in the neighborhood said, "We need the police here. That we need the police." The police came. They set up checkpoints. Within a few days, people were like, "Get the police out of here, please." But police didn't go. And now Trinidad, since the checkpoint time, has become ground zero for police brutality. Young man named Trey Joyner, shot in the back of the head in the alley in the middle of the day, killed. Article is in socialistworker.org if people want to read it. We contacted a group that has an organization there, the ACLU, actually in the neighborhood, and we said, "We need to do a rally there. We need to show people that we're not going to be scared. We need to be in the streets." And they said, "Well, we have another plan. We're going to do a basketball game between the cops and the community, and it's going to be called Shoot Baskets, Not People." And it's just like, someone actually went to the game with a sign that said "Shoot Baskets, Not Us." It's just terrible. But you know what happened is that a group of people on their own started tailing the mayor around town, and they had signs that said, "I am Trey Joyner, I am Oscar Grant." Now, these are kids in D.C., you know, saying that they feel a sense of empowerment because of what you guys are doing. So I just want to say right now in front of everybody, Jack, it would be an absolute honor if you could come to D.C. and speak to us about what you're doing. Just so people know, I asked Jack this already, and he said yes in private. I'm not trying to pull up the spot. Like, you better say yes, because all these people are watching. But and the second thing, just before I sit down, just because it responds to something someone said, a lot of us in Maryland, I'm sure people know, were victims of COINTELPRO coming in our meetings, spying on us, sending in people, entered in databases that said anti-government /terrorist is how they entered us. And it wasn't just socialists and radicals. It was like the Chesapeake Crab Committee. Was spied upon, environmental groups, everybody. And just to say something about it is that the reaction of people was interesting. Like, people got freaked out about the COINTELPRO. And I don't think we can't get freaked out. We can't be looking at each other with suspicion. You know, we need to be welcoming new people in the struggle right now, because that's exactly what they want. I mean, it was crazy. We did a meeting, and one person said, "You know how you can tell the spies? It's the people who say all the radical stuff." Another person raised their hand and said, "You know how else you can tell the spies? It's the people who are always trying to be conservative." And we're like, who does that leave? You know? There's nobody left. So it's like, our attitude's got to be, we're open to everybody who wants to take part in the struggle in an open, committed, and democratic way. And if the spies try to penetrate us, well, you know what? We're going to build ourselves so big that they're just going to be like flies on our ass as we move forward. So that's all I have to say.
Right here, and one, let's see, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I'm sorry, I still have 5 or 6 people on the list, but we have to give it back to the speakers to wrap up.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm living in Berkeley now, but I'm originally from Texas, and we have a lot of things that are wrong there. So if the plague is going to hit the world, it might start with Texas. So anyway, I just wanted to share like a little bit of a story that I have heard from someone. I met this person named Jose, and he was going down from his apartment one night to like go get his diaper bag for his niece, and like 2 men approached him, like, and they're wearing all black, you know, and they like threw him on the like front of his truck. And like started like, you know, harassing him, and he like thought he was being kidnapped or like, you know, like gonna be murdered by just people on the street. And so he was like resisting, you know, like anyone would. And then they started yelling like, you know, get down, we're the police, right? And he's like, oh shit, like you're the police, you know? And then like the cop that was like manhandling, like knocked him down on the ground and like kicked him in the face, right? So he's like down and can't get up again, and like the guy that like had just hit him like went to the back of the car, and the other cop like came down and was like, you need to get a good lawyer, you know, like he like told him that, like, you're fucked now, you know, because this guy thinks he would like harass him. Sorry. So then that police officer pressed charges on him, and this is a kid who didn't have like ever have a record, and now he has like a felony for like assaulting a police officer who was like completely unmarked, you know? So anyway, like my point to this is like that there was this cop there who like obviously saw it was the wrong thing, right? But like he's not gonna tell on like his cop brother, you know? So like, and there's nobody that's outside of like the police academy that is doing internal investigations. And anytime like especially like, well, all I know about is in Texas, but like whenever there tries to be like an external review, like they shut it down and try and get to somebody who's been a cop or is a cop to do the review. So like I think that's another big problem with like being there anyway. So like, and also, thanks a lot for talking. Like, you've really opened my eyes to a lot of this stuff. But I didn't know anything before you guys started talking to me. So, thank you.
Catherine, I'm from Portland. I really feel like if you're going to win a struggle, you have to know your history, you have to know your enemy, and you need to know their tactics. And basically, in order to do that, I just want to kind of recommend a book. It's by one of my professors. He's awesome. It's called Beyond Bullets, The Suppression of Dissent in the United States. And he talks about COINTELPRO, he talks about the police, the tactics that they use, and goes through just the whole history. So if you're interested in the topic, I really recommend that book, Beyond Bullets, by Jules Boykoff. It's really great, and it'll give you all of this information and more.
Great. Real quick, I'm Aaron from San Francisco. Wanted to share a little bit of the budget fight that's been going on in the city. Because something that the speaker said really struck me. Not much of the speaker, but the mayor, Newsom, just cut $140 million out of Department of Public Health, Human Services, and a lot of these are programs that we organized going back in the 70s. And the 60s. This is our legacy of community power that's under attack right now. And at the same time, we went to City Hall and we've been tailing them all year trying to get them to put the funding back. He magically came up with $85 million for police just for the retirement, right? So even if they were going to keep us safe, that shooting us, like, they wouldn't be new ones on the street. These are retirement bonuses. At a time they said they were broke, they pulled $85 million more out of the community and just gave it away to the cops like that. So, also there's the Community Justice Center. I don't know if folks, everybody's from San Francisco, I know a lot of people have come out of town, but there's this other project where homeless people get ticketed and arrested in the city for sleeping on the street. And just basically activities that you need to do to survive. And they came up with an entire different course based on something that happened in New York, based on something that happened in LA. But they pulled out $3 million more to fund a court that had to be separate from the regular ones because the law is bullshit. And that money came out of shelters, right? So you're sending more people on the street, then ticketing them, and it costs millions and millions of dollars just to prosecute these phony tickets anyway. So that's why it's been going on all year, and I just wanted to give a kind of a report back so that at least a giant movement of people affected in the struggle are leading it, and that's a beautiful thing. And I'm going to say keep your eyes on it, and we miss you downtown.
Well, first of all, if you want to go to that preliminary hearing protest, please do see me after the meeting so we can organize that. The stats come, the statistics about criminality criminality, so-called, almost always come from state and federal agencies. And the thing that's surprising about them is that the interpretation is actually very hard to skew because it is so obvious that it is race and racial profiling which drives our criminal justice system. The reason I bring that here is because I want to say this is the International Socialist Organization's West Coast Socialist Conference. So I want to talk a little bit about why, what's going on here. This is also part of our way to say we want to build a multiracial civil rights movement. How do you do that? You get involved in cases like Oscar Grant's case, where we come together to do the one thing that law enforcement cannot stand, which is to see black, brown, and white people coming together to stand up for justice. For us to be successful in this, we have to continue to organize, which is why it is my privilege and my honor to say that when, you know, I've been to church more in the last 3 months than I have been in the last 10 years. Because that's where we organize in Oakland. And it isn't just churches, it's mosques. And it's a bunch of other places that we go as well. That's why Basola and I have talked about going out as a team to actually walk the street and go talk to people where they are. And it's those little steps, which seem small, but are essential for us to actually start making a bridge that we actually start to break down the racial divide that keeps us separated from each other and actually will let us go forward. Because we have great videotape in Oscar's case, but there's been videotape before. So I think that it does rely on the analysis that Dana put forward around the change. We don't put all of our hope in Barack Obama. It wasn't the checkered flag of crossing the finish line. It was the green flag of start your engine on rebuilding this when Barack Obama got elected. But it's also that we can actually take the lessons of history, which is what socialists do in these movements, and bring them forward and say, we're going to win. We're going to do it in a multiracial way. That's why it's essential for us to build not just a multiracial, but actively an anti-racist socialist organization that is going to participate in this stuff. And these are the steps that we are taking right here today, my friend.
Before I hand it back to the speakers, a couple quick announcements. Haymarket Books, right around the corner. Please go check it out. Some of the books that people recommended tonight are over there, and there's a whole section on criminal injustice that I think will help reinforce our understanding of how to rebuild this fight against political oppression. So check that out. So let's see. The conference will be starting tomorrow at 9:30 a.m. Check the schedule for where the meeting is located, whether it's at the Women's Building or whether it's here. Directions are in the brochure. And just remember to bring your ID badge again so that you don't have to get a new one at the registration table. Last but not least, DJ Inky Lab is in the house. What? We're having a party right here tonight. And what, 9:30 about?
9:30.
So you all have to roll out so we can set it up. And then at 9:30 you can come back and hear my man on the wheels of steel over there. I'm excited. What, you got something that... Okay. All right. Fantastic. So we'll see everybody back here on the dance floor in a minute. But before it becomes a dance floor, we have an important wrap-up. So...
Have
comments to
make about this discussion, please do so. All right, I'll say something. Right. So, I hate to be somber after your announcement about getting the party started, but when you say apartheid in America, I have to look around and say, wow, you know, that doesn't sound too far-fetched in some instances. I've been anti-democratic activist for 10 years, and actually, Maryland case was the first case that I worked around, Tyrone X. Gilliam, who we lost, and I met his family, and it horrified me, and, you know, it's kept me in it, and I want to reflect a little bit on this, because I think on one hand, you can say we are up against quite a beast, and it feels like there's a deafening amount of silence around the criminal justice system right now in a lot of ways. I mean, we talk about the fight against Prop 8 and around a number of other issues where it feels like, wow, we're on the offensive, it doesn't always feel that way when we talk about prisons and when we talk about the death penalty and when we talk about police brutality, because it is so pervasive and it's so horrifying and it happens so much. And if you live in Oakland, it happens every day. On my way driving to conference today, this morning, who's pulled over by the side of the road by the highway patrol? A black family in a car probably going on vacation for the 4th of July. And that can be like, it can really feel like we haven't made progress. What is this new era? What does it actually mean? But I think there's also, there's a new hope. And I think the hope is, it's not, some pie in the sky dream. It's the fact that right now we're at a crossroads in history where a number of things are happening that are bringing class politics and politics around oppression together in a way that I think is actually really, really significant. And it's, people like Jack standing up and talking about a whole number of issues. It's people in my workplace getting involved in the fight around Oscar Grant and linking up these issues. It's so important because these are the connections that are going to really matter. And these are the people who are in it for the long haul. And I think it is actually important that we say we're starting by organizing the people who are the most oppressed right now. I've been working with Daryl Lomax on death row for 4 years now. He is in this for the long haul. The people who are on death row are the people who are in it for the long haul. Their family members are in it for the long haul. The people who've lost loved ones at the hands of the police are in it for the long haul. That is where we start. That is the core of our movement right now. And that is the hope, I think, that we're going to continue to build and to grow, because we are committed to building a real multiracial fight back. And the things that Cameron said, I think, were just so inspiring. And there are some real chances for victory. Mezzerly, I think, based on the evidence that I've seen, and I was in court, and I would say, you want to talk about apartheid? Watching that video that was shown in court, that has not been released, by the way. Like, it's not the video that's on YouTube or whatever, that's horrifying. You hear the audio, you hear what they're saying. They're using racial epithets.
Yes.
They've got their knee on Oscar's back. It's horrifying. And to sit there and watch that, you can think that we live in an apartheid America, because these cops clearly thought they were going to get away with it. And the way they acted, they are the enemies on the platform. They are the riot police. They're absolutely out of control. But we stand a chance of getting one of them convicted and charged with murder. And that's a historic moment. And that's a victory. And that's important. Because I want every cop in Oakland, every time they reach for their gun, to think about Yohannes Mezzerly, the guy who got convicted. I am so honored to be able to speak with Richard Brown and Jack Bryson and people like that who inspire me every day. And it really is, that is the hope, I think. The hope is I've gotten to meet someone like Jack through this struggle. Gotten to meet someone like Daryl on death row. Gotten to meet someone like Richard Brown. And not only meet them, but work with them as allies. And I think that is the hope. And it is not some pie in the sky dream. We are up against a serious, seriously organized ruling class. And we should not take that lightly. The quote from Reagan rings very much true today. We should not take our fight lightly. But I do actually believe we are at a new era. And I think the potential to build a multiracial struggle that Cameron was talking about is very real. And that the folks in this room, the folks in this conference, I think are committed to doing it. And that is the real hope. So, thank you, everybody. Sorry, don't leave, Jackson.
It's an honor to work with you too. I'm going to share people like Dana, Cam, just everybody. And then Brian. I've read a lot of books, I've always studied this. But like I said, I didn't want to get involved because of what happened to the double agent stuff of it.
Right.
But I never thought, here's a young man from Hayward, California, Oscar Grant, 22 years old. I was honored to know him. In the beginning, I always said, I'll never forget the conversation me and him had. I was coming out of 7-Eleven one night. It was a hot summer night. And like I said, I'll never forget. She goes, "Hey, what's up, Big Jack?" And I said, "Hey, what's up, Oscar?" and sat there and talked for about 45 minutes about life and everything. And, you know, said he respected me, you know, as a father, because my son was living with me. I was raising my son. Still a parent, you know, back and forth. And, like, I'll show up at parties, you know, with my sons, or be at the football practices, or just, I was my son's basketball coach. I was, really, like, on my sons, you know, and then Oscar, you know, he asked me, man, why are you on your sons like that? And I said, man, Oscar, you know, tell me the truth, you know. Man, it's I don't want to leave my sons, you know. It's that's a parent's worst nightmare, you know. You don't think about it. If beautiful mother Wanda, she lost Oscar. And, you know, that's why it's so important to me to fight, because, you know, and when I'm in Oscar, you know, as soon as you tell me, man, don't trip, Big Jack, I got your sons. And if you knew all these young men, Mike, John, too, Carmel, Chris, you know, Nigel, all of them, you know, them young men on the platform, you know, yeah, they were black and brown, but they were all family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I tell everybody, the second gang was the Bart police officers. That's who the gang was, not these young men. And Richard Brown said something so important. After these police officers, you know, they were beating on Oscar, Mike. They had their tasers out. They called them the N-word. You know, what happened is what Richard Brown said, and everyone else, even when they were in court, you know, these young men, they stood up for everyone in the world. When they, you know, when they stood up to the police and said, man, you know, what's going on? Why are you doing this like this? With their hands up. You know, they stood up to the police officers. And what happened to standing up? Oscar was killed. Within 30 seconds of Oscar Grant being killed, he was called the bitch-ass nigga 3 times. And then he was shot. You know, Mike hasn't been the same. I'll never forget that phone call 5:30 in the morning. His mother screaming, and then it's like, Bart used to be my outlet. Bart used to, like, when I was tired or just wanted to read a book, I would get on Bart and just ride from one end to the other end, just, you know, meditate and speak and read a book. Yeah. I can't even get on Bart. I can't even, I don't care what time it is. I tell my sons, I don't care what time it is. Call me. You don't got to get on Bart. And they do. You know, and, Oscar was a beautiful young man. And, you know, I remember 2 weeks before Oscar was murdered, you know, I was getting a tattoo. And with my son, Oscar, you know, I love hanging around these young men, you know, when I could. I was with my son. And then Oscar walked in, you know, we hugged each other, and he looked at the tattoo I was getting. He said, that's clean. And then we started talking. I said, we were talking about sport. I said, Oscar, when you deep means good. I said, were you deep in football? He said, yeah, I was deep. I go about baseball. I said, no, he said basketball. He said, baseball was a sport. I said, couldn't you have made pros? He said, yeah, I could have made pros. You know, I could have made pros. You know, well, he never got that chance to be a star athletic. But right now, Oscar Grant is a star of the whole world.
That's right.
You know, I never thought that this young man from Hayward, California would be, like, I go to Gerald's house, and this dude got every fucking book in the world. Gerald, let me borrow that book. He taught me about Robert Smith. You know, everyone knows about Robert Smith. I'm saying his name correct? Everyone knows Robert Smith is? Robert Smith was
Robert Williams.
Robert, and he won't let me borrow that book. I want to have, you know, I want to have the spirit, but Robert Williams, I haven't been able to look it, but I plan on it. But I, like, to build this movement, you have to have the spirit of Che, you have to have the spirit of Malcolm, you have to have the spirit of Huey Newton, you have to have the spirit of Malcolm, Mark, everyone, you know, and that's through Oscar. Definitely, I got the spirit of Oscar, and that's why I will continue to fight. You know, and I didn't get to talk about Oscar tonight, but he was just talking about everybody else. You know, and I read his book, and I never thought that the connection between Oscar and, to me, one of the greatest men alive right now, blew my mind. You know, just reading his book, you know, I just love reading because he's like talking to me, man. This man is so articulate, man.
That's right.
This
You know, Oscar didn't get the chance. They killed Oscar right there. But like they're doing on Wumaya, Oscar Grant, I mean Wumaya, Troy Davis, Kevin Cooper, like you said, Jeremy, they're playing with their lives. You know, that's why we have to fight, you know. We don't know Wumaya's innocent. Let that man go, man. I mean, don't use him for your political game. Right. See, like everyone that's running for politics in Philadelphia saying, well, I'm the one that put Wumaya away, or I'm the one that's going to, you know, you're using that man as a political game.
Right.
Yeah.
Let that man go.
That's right.
You know, do the right thing. Yeah. Do the right thing. Kevin Cooper, I can't wait to meet him. Daryl, you know, I can't wait to meet all of them. And, you know, there's plenty of other people I want to meet, you know. And I always love him, you know. Young men I'm on a platform with him. Special young men, funny young men. Cameron got to meet him. Dan got to meet him. You know, and he's got a history. I want to thank everybody here for all your support. And at first, I didn't even know how to talk, man. But
you figured it out, didn't
you? Figured my way out. Can't wait to go to Washington, D.C.
Hell yeah.
That'd be an honor. And, just, you know, like I said, love everyone. Thank you for the support. I can't forget about T.B. Williams and Barbara Winters.
Yeah.
Barbara, she just, you know, just watching that video of her, I watched that movie over and over and studied. I talked about everyone else's spirit, but I also want to have the spirit of her because she never backed down. She is a fighter and she's a leader. So I love her.
Thanks, everybody. I'll see you back here in a half hour. Bring your badge so you can get in.